listener production.
The creators of this podcast would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which it is recorded. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are the first storytellers of this land. We pay respect to their elders, past, present, and emerging, as well as any Indigenous people who may be listening today.
All right, everyone relax. This is Tofop with Friends. I am joined by a new friend today. I actually reached out to this person for an episode of Willosophy because I'd wanted to have them on my other podcast, Willosophy, which you can find in this very same feed at Everyone Relax. But here's the thing. When I reached out to today's guest, I then discovered that they were about to come and do a show at the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. And if we did a Willosophy episode, it wouldn't come out in time for us to talk about this show at the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. And at the moment, we live in a world where comedy festivals are shutting down day by day. We don't know if these comedy festivals are going to keep happening. So I don't think we can take the risk of waiting to talk about next year's Melbourne International Comedy Festival. We have to talk about this year's. So we put him onto a Tofop with Friends so you can hear from him. That is a very long-winded way to introduce today's guest, but I'm pleased to have him on the show, Paul Williams. Hello, Paul Williams.
Hello, Will Anderson. Thank you for having me. And I appreciate you putting me on this podcast instead of the other one.
Yeah, thank you.
It means the world.
Well, I mean, I think, Paul, in my head, there was part of me that's like, all the podcasts are in the same feed. They're only differentiated by brand and name only within the feed. But there are still some people who make a little choice based on, no, I like Willosophy. It's longer, you know, talking about the world a little bit more, you know. I understand that, like that some people like to be introduced to people through that format, but it really, it's just us talking and we can dress that up only so much.
Great. Well, you know, I prefer this one. So
yeah, thank you, Paul.
You know, I was hoping for this one.
Yeah. Now, Paul, the reason I wanted to have you on this one was because I literally wanted to talk to you about the fact that you're doing a show in Australia at the Melbourne International Comedy Festival, because as soon as I heard that you were doing this show, I went and read the blurb that has been submitted that describes what's happening in your show, and I could not tell whether that was true or just something you'd made up to fill the space and it was just meant to be a funny thing that you'd said, and I was like, oh, good, well, no, that's enough. Let's talk about that.
I personally don't fully remember what I submitted as the blurb, but I think it's true, if I remember correctly. But the show is a shambles currently. But I've still got a few. We've got a few weeks.
Yes.
To get it right. And are you doing Melbourne this year?
I am. I'm currently in Adelaide at the Adelaide Fringe Festival. So I've done
Fringe.
I've done two shows of mine so far. So mine's still in, you know, some sort of shambolic, you know, mess of its own, finding its own shape. Like, how much do you practice stuff before you take it into a show? Because I have post-pandemic, like it was out of necessity when the pandemic, the first show I wrote out of the pandemic was all written without ever trying any of it. The first time that I got to try any of it was like when it was a whole show. And I really quite liked the way that that went, because there is a small part of me that thinks sometimes I test my jokes on audiences that would not pay to see a ticket to come and see my show, and they're the wrong people to test the jokes on. You know, like the people who actually would pay to see my show would enjoy it. This club here 100%. Right now don't enjoy it. And I wonder with you what – yeah, go on.
No, 100% agree with that. I was doing a lot of – I was recently in the UK for a while, and I was doing probably way more gigs there than I would have done in New Zealand. But I kind of do that a lot. Just write a show that's an hour and go and do it, rather than the more traditional technique of trying stuff out. and you weed it out as you do the hour a few times. You're like, well, that bit has got to go now, and that bit's great, but. But yeah, I don't know.
No, but I think there's an argument to be made because, like, I mean, and this is obviously just reframing through my own prism because it's decided what I prefer to do. So I'm now trying to back justify why this is a bold creative choice that we're all should be making. But I do think there is an element of, are you robbing the audience who would really love a Paul Williams show by going out and taking those Paul, like, their idea, they're your audience. They like the way your brain works. They like your comedy. They would probably like the idea that you thought up for your show. You know, you might have to work it a little bit to get it exactly right. But ideally, your audience would like the stuff that you're making and presenting to them. And sometimes I think we get this extra step in between, which is before I present my idea to my audience, I'm going to show it to a whole bunch of people who are not my audience that have gathered here for no other reason than to rob my audience of an experience they might have enjoyed.
100%. 100%. And I find it shocking when people prefer doing small spots to like a full hour, because for me, I'm like, I get quite stressed doing a lineup show because like no one's necessarily there to see me. And when I'm doing an hour, I like to think it's like a kind of, I've got home court advantage a bit because they bought a ticket to see it. Yeah. So I think your theory makes a lot of sense.
How is the difference? Because like your sense of humor, like it's very hard to ask somebody to describe exactly what it is that they do for people. And it can obviously be different in different environments anyway. But you've become a little bit more well known now. And has like people's expectations of who you are changed the way that they react to your sense of humor or like your character, like in real life and on stage?
I would say, yeah, I reckon for sure. Like I noticed just between, like I did Edinburgh a couple times, pre doing Taskmaster and then afterwards. And I just found like the crowd was so much better. And I think it was probably just more that, you know, the right people were coming rather than, I don't actually know who was coming prior, but but it was harder.
I mean, I think there is a difference between like a group of people sitting in a room wondering, is this a thing, versus yeah. like a group of people who've already agreed it is a thing and they want to come and see the thing, right? Like, you know, to use another Taskmaster person, I think Sam Campbell is the greatest example of that, because people within the comedy industry for years have like known how funny Sam Campbell was. But like to the outside industry, if you were somebody who didn't already understand that Sam Campbell was funny, sometimes you could sit in a Sam Campbell show and not understand if it was funny or not, if you know what I mean. Like there is that for sure. sort of level yeah. of, is he really good at this and that's why this is like this? Or is there a level of lack of competence that I'm reading on stage? And that can be like a fine line to play with. If you play in that gap of, you know, am I deliberately downplaying this or presenting it in this way versus, you know, is this just somebody who's not capable of pulling this off?
Yeah, and for sure. And the quote that I used, which was from a Chortle review from years ago, and I wish I could pull it up right now, but I'm scared if I open a tab, it's going to make my internet go bad. But it was along the lines of like kind of whether or not the clumsiness, whether it's intentional or not, is difficult to ascertain. And I kind of like that. I kind of like yeah. that. Like last year when I did Edinburgh, a lot of people after the show would be like, was that on purpose?
Yeah.
Was that bit real? And I'm like, I don't know.
I mean, do you know?
I kinda like
blurring. How much do you know of whether it's real or in, like?
I like to think I know. Yeah. I like to think I know, but I like do that like the to, audience doesn't
yeah,
know.
Yeah, but do you like to think, like, do you think that you know accurately? Like, are you giving yourself an accurate assessment of how much of it is on purpose and deliberate? And
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. But it is funny when you go to someone else's show and something goes wrong and you're like, I think as a fellow comedian, you're kind of often I'm like, I'm trying to do like the math and be like, was that on purpose? Was that something that they did as a mistake and then they've tried to bring back? Or I remember once going to Melbourne to see Tim Key, and he came out on stage and he was like, went to start the show. And then you could see he was like kind of patting his pocket, like, and you could see kind of fear in his eyes, like, I've left my, basically he'd left his poems, which he writes on playing cards. And so he, before like the music had stopped, it was like time to start. And then he just ran off stage and the crowd laughed because it was funny. And then suddenly we heard like doors banging, and there was just this long, awkward silence, and we could hear loud banging from outside. And then there was this, a long pause, and the crowd was very confused. And then basically he ran in the back and came on stage. And what had happened was, yeah, he'd left his – he was in the Melbourne Town Hall. He'd left his poems in his room, ran out to get them. But when he did that, he got locked out of the the venue. And the show was, had started, and then he had to he was basically found himself in a car park in the town hall, like was locked out, and then he had to go out onto the out the side through an alley, out onto the street, loop around onto the main street, come in through the like ticketed entrance, like talk to the ticketing people and be like, my show's on. But anyway, it was like, the thing is, like, the crowd didn't know this, no. But everyone was laughing.
Yes.
And it was funny. And it was just one of those things. And when I talked to him, he was like, oh, that was horrible. But I was like, it was funny in the crowd. But anyway.
I mean, but that's the other thing is, there is that sense of, because comedy is all of these things, right? Like, it is often both real and unreal all at once. That's good. That's the state in which you want it to exist, because then the ones who are replicating that sort of thing, like if that was the bit that was happening every night, it still works well in the universe if there is a level of, oh no, some nights the bit is literally that he got locked out of his room and he had to beg his way back in through the ticket box office. Like, I mean, you need that to exist for the ones who are doing it as an illusion, for the illusion to work, right?
For sure, yeah.
How different is your show from night to night then? That's maybe a different way to like ask the same question. Like if I went and saw it on like a Tuesday night, a Wednesday night and a Thursday night, like how different or exactly the same would the show present as?
I think it depends. Like last year, I'd say like early run in Edinburgh, it was actually two Edinburghs ago now, I would say it was pretty the same, but then I guess I was changing it. But then like, as you get more relaxed and know the show, like I think it becomes kind of looser and you, I don't know. I think it depends when you see it in its lifespan, I guess. What about you?
I mean, early on, yeah, absolutely. Different. So different all the time. Like, but also I'm trying to lean into that a lot more because I do think that, you know, people have different skill sets as comedians. People who listen to my podcast, you know, when I have like one comedy theory and it's not even that good or original, but I trot it out so often in relation to everything. And here it comes again, if you're playing the drinking game. But I really do think I talk about it a lot because obviously it's something I think about a lot when I'm putting my stuff together, and that there are two kind of really separate states in a way of comedy, which is we do these two really weird different jobs, which is one is an act of pure creation, taking nothing and turning it into something. And then the other one is just replication. And I'm not saying that one of them is better than the other. Like there are some people who are incredible replicators. That's a bit of it they're really good at, being able to go out every night and nail that joke and nail that, you know, act out and, you know, like just elevate it to that next level. That's their skill set. For me, the joy's in like the spark of creation. So my favorite bits are like really when it's completely blank page and it could be anything, or this moment when you've kind of decided what it mostly is, but you haven't fully locked down exactly what it is. So there's still like an energy of creation in it every night. And the more you lock in, the more you go, okay, this is how I'm going to do this bit from now on, the more you actually drain the show of that spark of energy. Because if you lock something in place, yeah, it doesn't need creation anymore. It just needs recreation now. And so I try to keep, for as long as I can, without being a pain about it, try to keep that spark of creation in the show. Just keep some of it loose or some of it still in flux, just so I can have that energy in it for as long as possible.
Yeah. Okay. I like that. Yesterday I was talking to a comedian friend, and he brought up a song that I'd done like hundreds of times probably. Mm. And he just said, he said like kind of the joke of the song in a way that suddenly I was like, oh yeah, that's funny. And it's like, I'd forgotten, I'd basically done the song so many times that I'd forgotten like the funny thing about it. And yeah, it was just kind of interesting. But it does happen with the repetition. You can kind of lose the magic of it.
Right. Because the magic is actually, it's such a funny job. Like, because often what we're doing is trying to come up with that great moment of like that, the energy of the first time you get the joke right or tell it in the right way or connect it with an audience or, you know, whatever it is comes together. That's the magical moment. And then what we do is go, okay, well, that's the marker. We'll lock that in. We'll try to do it that way every night so I can get that reaction, rather than being the person that was able to, in that moment, get it that way with that audience that night. Like, I think it's just a weird way of us going, we lock it. Because the person who came up with the joke in your song in the first place, at some stage, created that. It came out of nowhere. That was the spark and the energy. And then after a while, you were like, oh, I just wasn't connecting with that anymore because I'd sung it so many times. Anyway.
And so often, the first time you do it, it's like the best it ever goes. And it's like the audience can sense that there's that like nervous and sort of, there's that magic. They can just sense it.
But they also know that it's an authentic thing. You're trying it for the first time. It's for them and you're catering it to them. The next night, I don't know why that this example has come to my mind because it's not the area I like to work for analogies, but like it is very much like trying your moves in the bedroom on a new partner and just going, this one worked for my last one. This will also get you off. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not like you've taken the time to learn what that audience, like the first time you did it, you were catering it specifically, you know, you're the one. You're my first one. This is an authentic experience. Yeah. Second time you're like, nah, this will work. This is my move.
Yeah. But yeah, I definitely like the dream is to be as sort of loose and shambolic as possible, I think. And free to try new stuff. But I think when I'm nervous, I'll just stick to what I've got. But I try and avoid it. I had the first time I came to Melbourne, my best show, like it was, you know, on Sundays, the shows are often an hour early.
Yes.
Is it Sundays?
Yes.
And so I'm bad with times and stuff. And I was doing a show in Trades Hall in Melbourne. And so I went to, is it Carlton, which is nearby?
Yeah.
And I went to like a Italian restaurant. I got there, I was a bit early, went and ate a huge thing of pasta. And then I was like walking and I was like, I've got heaps of time to kill before my show. So I'll just, I've got 30 minutes, I'll go for a walk. Yeah. And then my phone rang and it was my manager being like, where are you? Because it was, you know, the show was supposed to start. And so I sprinted there. I was like, wasn't that close. Sprinted there and just full of so much pasta. Yeah. And the crowd was already going in and I like remember running past them and then being like, that's the guy. And like going in and like quickly setting everything up and getting changed behind a tiny curtain and then having to run out onto stage. And like, I remember like tripping over the, my projector stand, like as I came on and like knocked it over. And throughout the show, I was like, I kept having to kind of pause to do like sort of pasta like burps in my mouth. It was really horrible. But it was like honestly like the best show I did the whole run, like maybe ever, because I was like, it was just so, there was such sort of like frantic energy.
Yeah.
And
so like what is there part of you that thought that is what you should be replicating like every night? Because if you're an athlete, right, like if you're playing for the All Blacks or like, you know, like cricket for New Zealand, right? Like in this situation, and like on the morning of your big Test 100, you've eaten a big bowl of pasta and then been late to the game and had to rush there. You would then incorporate that into your ongoing schedule for future performances. Have you ever considered replicating the pasta dash like entrance to a show? It's like,
no, I mean, for other things, yes. I mean, not for that, but I think that's too, yeah, I don't know. Maybe I could try. I guess like last time I did Edinburgh, I was constantly running late. So I guess maybe I subconsciously, I don't think I can take credit for it. I think I'm just often late. But yeah, I did have a similar one.
Is there a thing about being late where you lean into it and you just kind of make it your thing, like in the sense of not that you're rude, that you are somebody who, like, you know, you need that level of adrenaline for your performance. Like, you know, some people are, you know, drinking or taking drugs backstage. You've just got to say to people, you know what, sometimes I'm going to like toe that line because, you know, that's just what I need to, you know, bring the full Paul Williams experience to the stage.
Yeah. Honestly, I think there is maybe part of me that's like, because, you know, if you get there super early and you're sitting around, you know, you could psych yourself out. But if you're just coming in hot, you know, often I'll bike there and just go kind of straight into it. It is kind of an energizer, I think.
Yeah.
So maybe it is intentional. I've never thought of it as being intentional.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. You've got to rebrand it, regardless of whether it is or not. Yeah. You've got to say it is what I'm saying, because you might as well like just rebrand it as a positive, regardless of whether it is or not, you know. Because then people will talk about it. They'll be like, you know what Paul Williams does? He says the best thing is you've got to be as late as possible for the adrenaline. Like, people will start to talk about that.
Yeah. Okay. This is the start of it. This podcast. I'm always late to my shows. Yeah. I get there bang on start time.
Like, I mean, imagine if that was your reputation, and then that crowd at Trades Hall, they see you running by and they're like, oh my God, it's true. It is. This is we're seeing it right here.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
If people were going to, like, I mean, if there was going to be a rumor about you, like, and your method or your, like, just something that you did, like, is there either a thing that you could see people talking about, or is there just one that you would like to, you know, like, that you would love that people thought about you or said about you? Because there's always famous stories about comedians in a particular way they do things. Chris Rock goes to New York clubs and won't, you know, he'll only read his jokes off his notepad or whatever, you know, the mythology might be. What would it be for Paul Williams?
Oh, I mean, I've never thought about this, but I think maybe the late thing is it now.
Yeah, okay, lean into late. Yeah.
Do you have anything?
I mean, I would like to think that I would. Like, I mean, I haven't thought of it. I like to ask questions before I've ever thought about them in relation to myself. But I think that I would like it to be something that, is so weird that no one can work out, like, why it's part of the process. Actually, there is a thing that I do. Okay, this is actually pretty much is genuinely a thing that I do. So years ago, I decided that when you do a lot of shows, that sometimes, like, you know, the problem with doing shows at night is that you fill in your days. And particularly if you are, like, you know, in a festival or something, like, there's a lot of demands, there's a lot of different things to do. So people will fill in your day. And then you get to nighttime, which is when you're meant to be at your absolute best, ready to do the show, and you're kind of tired and your day's done, and you've, like, so I decided every year I would write a joke about cake into my show, and then on the day of, like, any show day, I would always treat myself during the day to, like, a piece of cake. And then I would always, like, when I was, like, doing the joke in the show that night, think about the specific piece of cake that I ate during the day. And I guess in a way it's to keep the show connected to that day, right? Like, in that moment when I'm talking about cake, I'm thinking about that day's specific cake. And I used to joke it was so I could claim that cake on my tax, which is not something you can do. But, like, But I like the idea of that. Maybe this cake thing could be my thing. Like, you know, Will Anderson, he has a piece of cake on show day, every show day. And it's to ground him in the experience of being there for the show. He thinks of that piece of cake and that like makes him think about that audience. Yeah. And I feel like that could work as like a, don't you think?
Yeah.
How do you feel
differently
about that?
Oh, 100%. I've never heard of that. And I think that's kind of genius. And it's a great way to justify eating lots of cake.
I mean, that's mostly what it is. Like Paul, let's be honest. That's mostly what it is.
Yeah.
But I think that's the best thing about these sort of things is like they're mostly got to be a justification for something else, right? So mine is I've inbuilt into my day. And like I will interpret cake in like a lot of different ways. Yesterday I had a dessert-style banana bread and I considered that to be my daily cake, despite the fact that it was called banana bread. It was definitely like banana bread toasted is always cake. It's toasted cake. But like even when you put butter on it, but this was like one of those fancy ones that comes with like fruits and like some sort of whipped, you know, dessert like, you know, topping on the side. So that's definitely cake. That counts as a cake.
That's cake.
Yeah.
I mean, I do wonder what is the difference between, like, in terms of recipe, a banana bread and a banana cake. Like, that's worth looking into. Is that the same thing?
They're the same thing. It's just different amounts of the same ingredient. It's a different pan.
Yeah, right.
There's no difference. Yeah. It's some real Australia, New Zealand areas, you know? Like, to us, we're very different. I'm sure banana bread and banana cake have very strong lines of rugby league, rugby union, very strong lines of delineation that they're completely different. But to people looking from the outside, people who don't understand the nuances, they can present quite similarly.
What is Australia in terms of bread or cake?
Oh, you know what? That's actually a really good point. What is Australia? Is it bread or cake? Like it feels.
And New Zealand. Like I think I want to think. I think we're going to argue over who's the cake.
In what way? Do you think the cake is superior or not? That's the first.
I think banana cake. Over banana bread.
Why?
For sure.
Why?
I guess in my mind, I haven't had banana bread in a long time.
Yeah.
But I think when I think of banana cake, I think of icing.
Mm-hmm.
When I think of banana bread, I think of no icing.
Uh-huh.
And to me, that's maybe the difference. And that's a huge improvement, having icing.
I mean, I agree. But it isn't really... the difference between the bread and the cake. This is what we're talking about. We're talking about something that you're spreading on top of the cake more than, so you can technically take that same icing and put it on your banana bread. And, we've reached ourselves a little detente. I believe you've defined the difference between the two. But I guess the banana bread comes with the icing standard, whereas I love icing. Yeah. Totally get that. Totally understand what you're saying. Also love myself. The idea of a cake that you can toast. I just don't know. There's something about like the idea of like toasting, you know, like heating it up, making it a little bit burnt, putting some butter on it. Like I love cake and I love icing, but there is something great about getting a slice of cake, toasting it and then buttering it and then eating it.
Mm. I once had an experience at a Melbourne cafe where I ordered French toast. But it was banana bread French toast.
Oh, okay.
And when it came, it was it can only be described as a standard piece of banana bread.
Yeah.
And I got into an argument with a friend because they said, "No,
I honestly thought there was going to be more to that sentence, but it was just some banana bread."
Yeah, but I was arguing that it's not, they can't say that's French toast because the French toast you dip it in a like a batter and you fry it, right? That's French toast. You can't, like, what part of it was French?
I mean, it was just toasted, right? Yeah.
I don't even know if it was toasted. It might have been toasted.
I mean, you'd hope it was toasted if they've suggested it's French toast. Yeah. You'd hope at least it's been toasted. But like I mean, I can't even quite understand places that are trying to sell me banana bread that isn't toasted, to be honest. Like if we're really going to get into the weeds on this topic, which I'd love to, is like, I understand maybe some people enjoy a fresh banana bread, but it should, I mean, I would have thought the majority of like banana bread should come like heated up, toasted, like, you know, crisp a little. That feels like that's the proper way to serve it.
I think the fact that, like, I don't see banana bread in New Zealand much at all.
Is that right?
And the fact that it seems like you're seeing it a lot.
I am.
To me, this implies that Australia is banana bread and New Zealand is...
I think that's true.
...is banana cake.
Do they grow bananas in New Zealand? Is there anywhere in New Zealand that grows bananas? Is that, like, it doesn't feel... I mean, like, it's not immediately coming to mind, is it? See, that's going to be the difference. It's like, because it's only up in, like Queensland in Australia, you got to get a little bit of heat to grow yourself a banana. And so it's a more a tropical thing. We have the big banana. It's a popular tourist attraction in Coffs Harbour. You can go and visit the big banana. It's a big banana.
Like a metal.
It's a giant metal banana. Yeah. But it's really big, like, for a banana. Like
New Zealand does that. Does that a lot in small towns. Yeah. They'll just make a huge sheep or a big whatever. And it's a good marketing ploy for your small town. But yeah, we don't have any big bananas.
So what is the, is there like a, because in Australia we love a big thing as well. And sort of your more famous Australian icons would be big pineapple, big banana, the big prawn, the giant prawn outside Ballina. the giant merino at Goulburn where the gift shop was in the rear of the merino, and of course famously the giant cigar in Churchill because of Winston Churchill. They built a giant cigar.
That is loose.
That's mad. And the giant Ned Kelly in Glen Rowan. So there's a giant the statue of the bushranger Ned Kelly in Glen Rowan.
Yeah. New Zealand. Wait, I've actually, let's see. Big apple, big bicycle, big bull. I'm looking at a list. Big carrot, big dairy whip. I don't even know what that is. Big gumboot, big kiwi fruit, big kiwis, a big LMP bottle. That's the most famous, actually.
Oh, really?
LMP is LMP is a New Zealand soft drink for anyone who doesn't know. It's basically you've got a version. What's it called? What's the lemon soft drink you guys have?
Lift?
No, not Lift.
Solo.
Solo. LMP is our Solo, basically.
It's not though, is it? It tastes different.
It's a bit different. It is. It's a bit different. Big sheep. Well, we've got a big prawn as well.
Oh, you also have a big prawn.
Yeah, I haven't seen the big prawn. Okay. But there's a big prawn at the Hooker Prawn Park. Mm. Jandal, cow. Oh, I mean, there's heaps. Crayfish, donut.
I mean, that feels like a lot, though. Mm. That actually does feel like a lot of big things.
Yeah, the most famous is the LMP bottle, which is in Pairoa, which is where is the P in LMP stands. It's lemon and Pairoa. People think it's an ingredient, but it's the place. And they have a huge bottle. But then at the other end of the town, some cafe has also tried to make like a knockoff big bottle. And if you come in from the north heading south, you see that one first and you think that's it. And it's not it. It's way worse. But
that's bold. Anyway. That is bold in the same town. Just like
You know, it's probably half the size, but it's still quite big.
No. This is the Eiffel Tower, mate. No, you know, that big one over there is no good. You don't need to check that out. Oh man, that's the best. I love that. I do love somebody who's just spotted an opportunity to just go like that. Is the real person selling knockoff merchandise outside the, you know, the big rock concert, you know. I'm three blocks away from Taylor Swift selling Taylor Swift t-shirts.
I'm going to do that this year outside your Melbourne show.
Paul, can I, well, I mean, I would be rapt if somebody like, you know, had some knockoff merchandise, Woo Woo 2Ls, selling T-shirts outside the gig to people. I'd be fine with that. Have you ever had merchandise? Like, do you have any merchandise?
I briefly did it a couple years ago. I briefly did it. I'll bring it back sometime because it's fun. I think it's quite fun to design a T-shirt.
Yeah, so did you have T-shirts? Like, because, I mean, you are...
I had...
Yeah, what did you have? Tell me.
I had a few different T-shirts, just T-shirts.
And were the T-shirts like Paul Williams T-shirts, or were they based on a joke, or were they like a song, album title? Like, you know what I mean? Like, what was the vibe of these T-shirts?
It was more music. Yeah, it was like more my name and album title kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay, so like an old school music T-shirt, like.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. You're classic. Yeah. What about you?
No, well, I mean, I mean, there's heaps of shit, but like, it's never really convinced me that, I love band merchandise though, right? Like, and you're a musical person, so I was just wondering if you had that sort of, you know, I'm still wearing, literally band T-shirts, like, is basically all I still wear.
I love going to a concert. I'm a real sucker. Like, I actually go to the concert shirtless because I know I'm going to buy the T-shirt. And I leave with a hat and a T-shirt. If they did pants, I would just go no pants as well.
I mean, they should encourage that, honestly. They should say to people, like, there's like a fast lane at the concert. If you want to come to the gig and you want to kit yourself out in tight, because there's always such a big line for merchandise at those things, they should prioritize people. You're like, you go, mate, this guy's already got pants. I've got no pants. I literally need to buy some Ryan Adams pants right now. Yes, Ryan Adams. Yeah. That's who I went with for that reference of all the musicians in the entire world. Not Brian Adams, Ryan Adams. Oh, boy. Paul Williams, when you come into Melbourne to do this show of yours that you're coming to Melbourne to do, where are you doing it at? Where does that happen?
I am in a small room in the town hall, Melbourne Town Hall.
Do you know what the room is called?
I think it's called the backstage room.
Oh, yeah, I might be thinking of that room.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when you do the show in Melbourne, is that a new show? Like, will you have tried it somewhere? Are you going to be like,
I will have tried it approximately twice.
Okay.
I'm pretty nervous. So, so if you're going to come, give me a week. And then come.
Don't say that, because like, you need people to come early to help you work it out. Like, what you want to do, again, you're looking at, this is some real New Zealand thinking that you're bringing to the table here, my friend, and I've got to give you a little Australian swagger. And you've just got to reposition these early ones as the ones that people who are fans of yours really want to see. Come and help me work out the show. You know, come and see it, you know, in its early form when I'm still in the pure act of creation. You know, like, I mean, you want to encourage, because Big Four Houses early on, as you work it out, that's better. That's because that'll just help you help you work it out. Like, how do you know if there's no one there? Okay. Don't put them off. Don't tell them to come a week in. Tell them to come at the start.
And then come back at the end. And come at the end.
Yes, to see how, right? Buy two tickets.
I'll have no one in the middle.
I mean, you should do a deal where you offer people tickets to the first shows. If you buy tickets to the first shows, you also get free tickets to the last shows. It's not a bad deal to fill it up early. You're like, if you come to the first three, you have a guaranteed ticket any other night of the run where you actually want to come back.
That's not bad. Honestly, that's not bad. Come to the first one and come to the last one and see how much better it's gotten. That's the pitch.
Well, I mean, not even better, just different. They're both going to be great.
Yeah. Yeah, where are you at?
I don't know. Like, I mean, come see it. But oh. Like, not you. I mean, just generally to people. I don't. You specifically don't need to come see it.
I'll be there. I'll be there every night.
Every
I'm going to have to sell all these Will Anderson with 2L t-shirts.
It's true, actually. Can you sell them in the show? I'm happy for you. If you're going to come and watch the show every night anyway, wander the aisles.
Yeah, roaming popcorn salesman, but with t-shirts. Yeah.
With knockoff t-shirts.
Get your t-shirts.
Yeah, but with t-shirts, I'm not getting a cut off. Like, you're just doing this in the show every night, up and down the aisles. And people are like, I guess Will said this was fine. I've not said it's fine. I don't understand why it's happening, and yet it happens every night. You just come in brazenly with your t-shirts. You mentioned Taskmaster before, and I wanted to ask you a question about we were talking whenever it came up. We were talking about trust, and I was very interested in because the New Zealand Taskmaster, for people who don't know, and I'm sure people will know, but you're the Taskmaster's assistant on the New Zealand version of Taskmaster, and it's such a great series. Like, I do really think the New Zealand version is such a it's just brilliantly constructed, great challenges, the whole vibe of the whole show, all the contestants have been brilliant. It's just, it's so good. It's so entertaining on every level.
Oh, thank you.
But I also am so fascinated by talking to both New Zealand comics and Australian comedians who have been over to New Zealand to film the show, about just the experience of it itself, and how much of, so for people who don't know, people are filming 30 plus challenges in a few days, really, 3, 4, 5 days, not a lot of days. It's all happening at once. And the only person who is giving them any feedback to how it is they may or may not be going and what it is they are doing is the person who is the Taskmaster's assistant, you in the New Zealand version, Tom Cashman in the Australian version. But otherwise, it's a crew whose job it is to not let people know how they are going. And then these people are doing these series of things all day long with, I just think it's quite a very fascinating job, right? I imagine that most of the people who you have on the show are people that you knew already through the New Zealand comedy scene in some way, maybe in small ways, or maybe close friends, I imagine. It's not, the hugest scene in the world. And then you're in this hyper real scenario, with them, where they're thrown into something they're not used to, and you're the only person who's there to guide. But also, you are constricted by how much you can, engage within the role that you are playing there as well. Can you just, I'm just fascinated by that and what that's like as an experience for you.
Yeah. No, yeah, it's, I feel often sometimes I'll go in after they've done the task into their sort of bedroom they hang out in. And because sometimes you're you just need to kind of reassure them, because I feel people can go kind of crazy. And it's funny because often people will be so down on how they did, but it's I've seen the other four people. So in my head, I'm like, I know that they just won that task, but they'll be in there being I should have done this, I should have done that. And I'm there thinking no, you should see the other four.
Cause that's incredible. Yeah. It's an incredible thing from that point of view. Cause I just love thinking about this show as a piece of television, about the way that it's made. And I am so fascinated by this thing of you get these, five comedians, for people who haven't, seen the show, but I imagine people are familiar at the very least with the UK version of it. And they are making this show together. They all watch the videos of their tasks together. They compete in studio in, a range of tasks together. There is an element of the show that is all contextual and within the context of everybody being there together. But this other core element of the show is completely non-contextual to the people who are participating in it, and you're the only person who is there in that moment who has, yes, as you said, a true context for how it is that they have actually done, because how they've done is measured by not how they have done necessarily in them being able to complete something, but only how they've done in comparison to other people's capacity to do the exact same thing.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
It must be hard for you to, like, is it hard? Like, can it be difficult for you to not, like, you know, kind of engage on that level?
I'm personally very good at keeping secrets and not divulging information. So no, I've never really found it hard, but I guess sometimes if they're really down on how they've done, part of you wants to be like, trust me, like, you did okay. but generally I just kind of, will be like, you know, don't worry about it. You know, and people never get that down. It's all, I think most people are just kind of having fun most of the time, but yeah.
How is that experience of, like, the New Zealand version of the show has obviously, because the brand of the show is so beloved, like, internationally, you know, that New Zealand version has been quite popular outside of New Zealand. You know, it's traveled really well as, like, being something that people have enjoyed internationally. How has that been? Like, having that sort of, you know, kind of people all over the place, I imagine, you know, discovering it and you know, connecting with it.
Yeah, it's really cool. It's really cool. Like, it's obviously still, like, kind of very niche, but the people who like it really like it. So it's nice, like, occasionally to just be somewhere overseas and just someone in the street will just get really excited. and you're like, what? Like, this is, recently I was in Brussels and, like, a teenage girl from Greece was like, Taskmaster. And I was like, wow, like, that's crazy. Like, obviously she's illegally streamed it, which is fine, but it's not available in Greece. But anyway, so I called the police, I called the Brussels police and got her arrested. Yeah. But no, it's really cool. And obviously it has really helped with, you know, people coming and to see the shows in Edinburgh and Melbourne and whatnot. But it's a great fan base, a passionate fan base for sure.
When you're in Melbourne for the festival, are you doing the whole festival? Do you do the whole?
I am. Yeah.
So what do you do with the rest of your time when you're in Melbourne? Are you a person who, like, do you spend your days recovering? Are you a social person? Like, I mean, we've obviously heard about, you know, like, you know, eating a lot of pasta. You know, and walking the streets. But when you're not up to that, what are you doing?
I would say quite social, and I love Melbourne as a city. So I would get out and see the sights and go to the, you know, whatever, the art gallery or the go to an AFL game.
Oh, you will?
You know, touristy.
You'll do that sort of stuff. You throw yourself into this is what people do here. I'm going to do this thing.
Yeah, definitely. I think Melbourne is one of my favorite cities in the world. And it's probably less exciting for an Australian who are you Melbourne? You're New South Wales. You're Sydney.
I live in Sydney. Well, actually, technically, how's this? Like, you've caught me at a time in my life when we have this conversation where I am 4 days into having no fixed address at the moment. I moved out of my house like almost a year ago now, and then I'd been living in temporary accommodation, and now I'm out on tour on the road for months, and so I gave up the temporary accommodation. I have all my stuff's in storage, and I was checking into the hotel in Adelaide, and they said, you know, what's your home address? And I was like, this is, if you need to find me, this is where I am. Like, so you're at the moment, I am genuinely in a, like, I guess, like, I was saying this to someone, I was like, they were like, where do you live? And I was like, well, in Adelaide this week. Like, you know what I mean? That really is kind of, but yes, generally in New South Wales. I'm from Victoria originally, and, like, I started comedy in Melbourne.
Okay.
And then I went to Sydney for work and stuff. And the majority of my work's been out of there. But, But yeah, so, but I am an AFL person and I was raised in Victoria. So I kind of still a lot of, and obviously with the comedy festival, still a lot of my, you know, sort of worldview or like things that I'm passionate about are very much formed by, you know, being a Victorian or being like from Melbourne.
Yeah. Who's your AFL team?
I support the Western Bulldogs football team. Are you familiar with them? Footscray, they used to be called.
I am. Yeah. Yeah. I'm a Bombers, a diehard Bombers fan.
A diehard Bombers fan? Really? For how long have you been a diehard Bombers fan for?
I went to Melbourne when I was, I'd say, about 12 or 13. Okay. And they were playing that first night and I liked their plain logo.
Yes.
And so I picked them then. But I haven't seen many games.
No.
But I've got a scarf and they're my team.
Well, they are not great. And they have not been great for about all that time that you've supported them, to be honest. They've not been very good for most of that time. Yeah. They had a big drug scandal in that time. That
drug scandal. You know, I heard about that.
Yeah, that's been kind of the real highlight of that period of time for your club. My brother, Barracks Resident, that's his team. So my brother supports. We grew up in a family where, so my grandfather, James, he was a mad Collingwood supporter, the Collingwood Magpies. And all his kids, apart from my dad, all Barrack for Collingwood, and all the grandkids, apart from, you know, like Barrack for Collingwood as well. It was kind of the family tradition. But in my dad's family, my dad Barrack for Geelong, and he told us kids that we could all pick our own team. So my sister barracks for St Kilda and I barrack for the Bulldogs and my brother barracks for the Bombers. And so we have this like weird family where we all just support different teams. But it's quite, it's good. Yeah, we all quite like it as well. I did say to my dad, I said, well, you picked Geelong. Like, I love that you didn't pass on my kids now should barrack for Geelong. You passed on, I got to pick my own team, so you get to pick your own team. I thought that's a much cooler thing to pass on to the next generation, then you must do things the way that, you know, we did things, because that's what, you know, you could explore that for a deeper philosophy than I'm sure he was thinking of when he offered that choice to us. But, you know, retrospectively,
I think he assumed you were going to pick Geelong.
I mean, I should have. They would have been much more successful during that time. Like, it would have been a much wiser choice in retrospect. I would have had a lot more joy in my life if he just forced me to support his team and not my team.
Yeah, yeah. During the day, back to during the day in Melbourne, what do you do during the day?
Well, like, because Australia's home turf for me, I'm often working on other things, right? Like, we start TV in May, so I'm in pre-production already for that and stuff like that. So podcasts and doing stuff like this. So it doesn't get the same, I don't get the same level of, I'm away, you know, when I'm in Australia. That's why I like to travel to other places. I had years doing stand-up in America and I would be out on the road, like, you know, like I traveled to like 26 states in America to do stand up. And the way that it would work is you're just at a comedy club from say Tuesday or Wednesday to Saturday or Sunday, right? Like doing somewhere between 5 to 7 shows, you know, 45 minutes a night, every night. There's barely any commitments, maybe a couple of morning radio and like maybe a local TV station or what, a Good Morning Cleveland or whatever, right? But otherwise, your days entirely your own. Like you're in Chicago or you're in Cleveland or you're in like Alaska or whatever, and you can just go and, like, I think I was, what you were saying, if I was in Chicago, I'd be like, all right, what do people do when they go to Chicago? Because I'm having a week of doing Chicago things, whatever that might be, or I'm having a week of doing Minnesota things. Like, you know, I'm in Minneapolis, so I'm going to go and visit Prince's house and go to the world's biggest shopping mall, you know?
Yeah. That's me in Melbourne.
That's you in Melbourne.
Every day going to the neighbor's street every day.
Ramsey Street, mate. Ramsey Street.
Yeah.
It's actually a fair
way. I don't know what it's called, but I go there every day.
Well, not it's the most famous street in Australian show business, Ramsey Street.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
No?
No. Yeah, it rings a bell.
I mean, it rings a bell.
It rings a bell for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't come on this podcast and disrespect Shortland Street, right?
Like, sorry. But it's the name of the show. They should have named Neighbours Ramsey Street if they wanted me to know the name Ramsey Street.
Yeah, it's a good point, right?
It's the Neighbours Street.
Yeah, okay. All right. I'm willing to concede the point that you've made. I think you've made it well, to be honest. When you were rebutting me, I was like, I don't know why I've introduced that as an argument, because that is a terrible argument, because one is called Neighbours and one is called Shortland Street, and I don't know a second thing about Shortland Street. Like, I was expecting you to know a second thing about Neighbours, which was what is the street on which the show is called. I don't know a second thing about Shortland Street. I literally know the name of the show.
You'd probably know the iconic character I played in 2014, Young Man on Shortland Street.
You were Young Man on Shortland Street?
I played Young Man, in one episode.
Hang on.
It was huge for me.
So what was this Young Man up to in this episode of Shortland Street?
Basically, there's one of the most famous characters, Chris Warner.
Yeah.
He'd moved into a new house, was a big storyline. But next door, he was concerned that his neighbors were criminals.
Yeah.
And basically, I was a shady young man.
Oh, you're a shady young man.
I was knocking on the door. Well, I was just young man, but, you know.
But like,
I was shady.
Yeah, because you're a young man.
Yeah, let's just put it this way. I was wearing a hoodie with maybe the hood up.
Oh.
And
a hood up hoodie.
And I was knocking on the door.
Yeah.
Well, and it was a hot summer's day.
Well, that is shady. Like, why are you wearing a hoodie up on a hot summer's day? That's shady. Yeah. On two levels.
And I knock on the door and he answers it and he's like, hello. And I'm like, Pete. And he's like, no. And I'm like, where's Pete? And he's like, I think you want next door. And that was basically the scene.
Implying that you're some shady youth who's like going over to Pete's place for some shady behavior.
Yeah.
Right? Okay.
Exactly.
Uh-huh. And you're but so scattered on your shadiness that you don't even know which number you're meant to be going to.
Yeah.
Notoriously a thing that people who are visiting criminals do all the time, mistakenly go to next door and knock on the door.
Yeah. But during the takes of it, I remember I had to walk up and knock on the door a bunch, and I looked down the street and I saw that my car, because I'd been in famous Paul Williams fashion running late to the taping, and I parked my car and I ran in, but this is the only time this has ever happened. I must have left the handbrake off and my car had rolled very slowly up across the footpath, across someone's front lawn and crashed into their wall. And I was like freaking out. I was freaking out as I was filming it because I was this is a disaster.
But do you know this has happened before you've gone to set, or this is like while you're on set?
No. This is a realization while we're filming. I'm like ready to go and I look up the street and I see my car suddenly up against someone's front of their house.
No, that's not true.
And I'm like, no, this is 100% true. And I'm like, I do the math and I'm like, okay, I guess I left the handbrake off and it's rolled there. And I then see the person from the house standing out there looking at it. And I'm like, well, I've just got to finish this and then go and, you know, sort this out.
While you're being shady young man, you've done...
While I'm playing the...
I mean, this is...
Yeah,
this is
I've done something this accidentally is, shady.
This is like Daniel Day-Lewis level of method that you're bringing to the table here the role of shady young man on Shortland Street.
Yeah. Exactly. But ultimately... I finish and I get dressed out of my hoodie and I go to the car and the person whose house it is has left a note under the windscreen. But I look at the front to see the damage I've caused and it's actually stopped, you know, half a foot short of the house, which is good.
That is good.
So it's just parked there on their grass up a foot away from their house. And I grab the piece of paper and it just says, don't park here. So they just thought I'd just driven up onto there.
This is.
But anyway, Shortland Street.
don't park here. They've looked at that. Their immediate assumption is someone's done this on purpose.
Yeah. I mean, it is kind of the only explanation. Like, you don't expect someone's car to slowly roll up to your house.
I don't know. Like, it seems unusual to me if there was like a incline such that that could happen, that it was the first time that it had ever happened. That's all I would suggest. Like, is it, if the possibility exists that it can happen, it would surprise me that yours was the first time that it had happened.
But yeah, just the fact that I'd gotten out, locked the car, I didn't have a, to tell you, my car, it wasn't a button pressing, it was a key in, and so I did all that, left, and like I didn't see it rolling. So it must have happened pretty gradually, I think, is my theory. But anyway.
I mean, that is some good quality Shortland Street, like, anecdotes. Like, I mean, I did not really realize that. I mean, when we were exploring Young Man, I was thinking, well, this probably isn't going to go very far. This is a little funny thing. I didn't realize we were going to have this whole rolling car story. Have you ever been in a car accident? Like,
not. Oh, actually, once. Yeah.
Yeah.
Once I was.
Were you
in
the driver?
New York.
Oh, New York City.
I was not. I was in an Uber.
Yeah.
And the Uber driver crashed, and it made me miss a flight.
Really?
And yeah, and the Uber driver was trying to kind of pressure me into saying it was the other guy's fault, and I was like, I didn't fully know, but I was like, it felt like it was more his fault.
Either way,
and then the police,
you don't want to get involved.
Yeah, the police then took me in a car, and I was like, they're gonna get me to my flight on time, but they took me in the other direction to a police station, and then were like, there's a phone on the wall and there's taxi numbers, and I was like, oh, this is really bad now. But anyway, what about you? Any accidents?
Yeah, two proper ones. Like, lots of little bits and pieces over the years, but two proper ones. One completely not my fault, and one completely my fault. Luckily, no one hurt in either of them. But one of them, I was in LA, and I got—I think they call it T-boning, but I don't know. I don't actually know. But basically, where someone drives like straight into the side of your car, it was like at a cross thing. Yeah. And so I had the right of way, I was doing the right thing, and they just like ran a red light and went straight through and smashed into the car. The car kind of like crumpled and like it was only about, the door kind of came in and was like, I would say, I don't know, like probably 10 centimeters away from like my chest, but like caved right in, like pretty close, like close enough that it was pretty terrifying. Close enough that this is the funniest thing about it, because it was like a big popular intersection in LA. There was heaps of witnesses. So there was no sort of like, there was none of that. I needed to get anyone to pretend that like the other guy, it was clearly the other person's fault. Everyone had seen it was the other person's fault. The police come up. This is my favorite bit about this. So I have almost the opposite experience. I'm clearly a little bit, like, in retrospect, I'm pretty sure if it was Australia, somebody would have suggested that I go to a hospital because of like what had just happened to me. But the police literally say to me, they go, you know what? Leave the keys in the car, call the insurance, like call the rental company, just go home. Like they were just like, they just said, leave the keys. This is not your problem anymore. And so I literally just this car just smashed in the middle of this major intersection, and I left the keys. I rang the hire company and literally have never thought about it or heard about it or anything ever again. Like they were just like, I had the insurance like on the car, and they just like took care of. Like, it was such a surreal experience, because it was like one of the worst things I've ever been through. And then just like, because it wasn't my car or my, like, I just walked away and was like, well, that's like, I guess that, like real Forrest Gump approach to like, and that's the end of that story. Yeah, so that was weird.
Amazing.
And then the other one was, right, isn't that weird?
Just walked off. Universal Studios just or something.
Like, seriously, I was like four blocks from my house, and so I just like walked back to where I was, like my apartment. I was like, that was weird. And then You know great. What? No, that's actually I forget. I remember now that actually I was on the way to a gig, so I had to walk back to the apartment and then ring the gig and say I can't come to the gig because I So there was actually something else I was meant to be doing, and the other one was when I was like just 18 years old, and I just like I had a car called a Holden Barina now. I don't know if they had the same brand, like, but it was just a tiny little, like, yeah, kind of the most affordable, economical little car that you could basically get, like, you know. And so I had this tiny little car, and my parents are, like, you know, farmers living in the country, and I was driving too fast down a, like, a, an unsealed road, like an old country dirt road, and the Barina hit the side of the road where there was, like, a dip that had fallen away with some rain, and in a miracle that to this day, like I did nothing to contribute to. This just is a thing that happened to me. Like I was the one who was going too fast and went off the road. But everything that happens after this is just luck. The car flips over like sideways. So like, you know, like it just flips completely over sideways. But because it's so light and I'm going so fast, it flips an entire 360 and lands back, like, on its tires. All four tires immediately pop, like, smash, like, you know, just from the thing.
Wow.
But other than that, really, the car was, like, not too bad, and I was alive. And
holy.
Yeah. And you know what the worst thing about it is? It took me years to be able to tell, because I, like, didn't want to tell my parents that like I just basically fucked up and like, you know, like, you know, yeah. I'd like made up some elaborate excuse about being run off the road and blah, blah, blah. Like, so I could never tell the true, the true story of this thing that, that had happened to me. But basically I was just going too fast, hit the side of the road, probably could have killed me. Like probably one of those stories that like in a whole bunch of other times would have just been like, this guy died on a country road and instead it just flipped over, flipped down. The tires exploded and I was just sitting there. Yeah, and because also I'm in the middle of nowhere. So like I had some real, like there was no one I had to pretend to be a ride in front of or, you know, like if there was someone else there, you'd be like dealing with that, their shock or whatever. But I'm just sitting in my Barina with four flat tires on the side of this road in the middle of, like also in the middle of nowhere, just kind of going, well, this is a fine mess you've got yourself into. That could have been, that could have gone a lot worse, I guess. You know, those moments where you're just like, oh yeah, you probably could have just died then.
Yeah. Have you had many close death experiences?
Oh,
near death.
Only a couple. Like I had another car related one where a big branch fell on my windscreen and nearly went off the side of it. It was up on a mountain, and it was one of those roads that has a big drop off, and so like a big there was that. And then once I got caught in a rip when I was swimming in the ocean,
terrifying,
and that nearly did me in. About you? Have you had any near death experiences?
Honestly, not really. There was one where it was like I was at this nice beach in New Zealand, and I was kind of like maybe a teenager, 18 or something, and I went climbing up this like bushy hill on this little like rocky island kind of thing, and up the top, and then I was coming down and it was so steep where I was coming down, it was like almost vertical like, and I was kind of going down by going from tree to tree, like kind of jumping from tree to tree to get down, and then at the bottom, there was basically just like a cliff dropping down to rocks below. And as I was doing it, then there was quite a big gap between the next tree. And so I ran. And when I hit the tree, it was just like a rotten like stump that was like completely dead. And it fell for like it broke and fell forward. And then I started plummeting down the hill, riding like a dead log, basically. And it was so scary. And I managed to just reach out my arm and grab a bunch of like kind of roots and swing off it. It was very sort of Indiana Jones. I swung off it and was like meters from the end where like I would have basically gone head first down towards the rocks at the bottom. And I just remember being like, I would have like I would have just died if I hadn't like gotten off that sliding log.
Oh my God.
Other than that,
I mean, that's pretty good though. That's a good, that's a, yeah, that's a pretty good one. Like if we end up having to make a Paul Williams story at some stage, hopefully for good reasons, hopefully it's like a, you know, like a biopic style celebration of your life. But you know, even if it's like, it takes a turn at some stage and it's some sort of hard hitting documentary about what went wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
Either way,
yeah,
I think we'll be able to use this as a very good scene in the early years of Paul. Yeah,
I think likewise with your car flip.
Yeah, totally right. Yeah,
feels you need a couple of those just to spice up your biopic. I think we knew that when we were setting those up. We were like, this will be a good scene.
Yeah, this will be good. This will they'll be able to extrapolate a lot out of this one moment. This will be fine.
Yeah.
Well, Paul Williams, tell people what your show's called. It's on at the Melbourne Town Hall. It's called
my show is called Mamiya 7, but yeah, my name as well is Paul Williams.
It'll be why is it called that? What is it? What is that?
Then it's basically my camera. I've got a camera that's is a Mamiya 7 film, old film camera, and that basically I bought it and it had a roll of film already in it, and I went in and I was kind of scared because I was like, my first thought was like, there, you know, there could be like a murder on this.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know what, or genitalia. And I took it and got it developed. And the show is kind of the photo. I kind of go through the photos because this, And that's basically the premise of the show. And there'll be other stuff just crowbarred in. But that's but that's the premise. Yeah.
Okay, well, that's pretty much what it says says in the blurb, apart from the whole other stuff will be crowbarred in as well line that you mustn't have had room for at the end of the blurb. But yes, come early and come late. That's what we're saying.
Yeah.
Come and see it at the start and then come and see it at the end. Yeah.
Yeah. If you're a real big fan, come in the middle to see that middle step as well.
I mean, you'd be a fool not to, is what I would say.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I say come opening weekend, like, you know, come like first preview, right? First preview.
Yeah.
Get in there right at the start. Like, you know, see what Paul thought the show was going to be. And then maybe like wait, like, you know, give yourself like a week and a half, check back in, I think.
Yeah.
And then that final week. I mean, you know, like don't maybe leave it until the last night because you never know, like, maybe Paul has like a big Saturday night, the last night. Maybe the final show is not his best show. Or maybe that's what you want to see.
Right.
Maybe you want to see the fond farewell to the – maybe at that point you can't get a ticket. Paul's been nominated for a whole bunch of awards for this found footage camera show that he's brought with extra crowbar material. And like, you know, you can't get a ticket. But you've been there since the start. You've been there since opening night, since preview night. Like, you know the journey – that we've like, I mean, all I'm saying is if there is going to be a journey like of that epic proportion, you would hate to have had the opportunity to say, I was there when it all started, like be that person, like one of those famous gigs where, you know, 14 people see the Sex Pistols, but they're all in famous bands later on in life. Like that could be you with Paul Williams' show on the very first night.
Yeah. I mean, if you want like the full sort of, like what I get with Taskmaster, you want the full picture.
Yeah.
Come every night. And then you can really get the full picture. That's, I think, the real way to do it.
Yeah. You can truly only understanding it.
Yeah. Yeah. To get the full story, come every night. And that's what I'll be seeing every night at your show as I roam the aisles selling t-shirts.
I mean, I'm not against the t-shirt idea. And I'm like, I'm happy for you to literally take 100% of the profits. I just like the bit of you every night in my show wondering, just seeing if you can sell Will with two L's merchandise. and will legitimate with two L's. You refuse, and then I'm going to respond by coming to your gig and selling Paul Williams with one L merchandise during your show.
Yeah. I might steal your show naming technique, because I have I have Will in my surname.
It's true.
So, next year, losing the will to live, Paul Williams.
It's amazing that you've gone immediately to losing the will to live. Of all the ones that you had available to you, like not even.
Well, you've gone through a lot, right?
Yeah, but it's weird that you could have gone with like will to live. Like will to live would have been fine, but you had to add.
Right.
It is me, Paul Williams, and I am losing the will to live.
That's very true. That's very true, and that's probably a bad indication of where I'm at with this pre-Melbourne stress.
Well, Paul Williams, it has been a delight. People can catch New Zealand Taskmaster. If you're in Australia listening to this, I believe it is available on Foxtel or Binge. You can find the New Zealand version of Taskmaster. But if you're listening in other places in the world, I know that you can find it where you are. You can find it anywhere.
Yeah.
Brussels authorities are doing nothing about it. They're not cracking down on illegal views of Taskmaster. So you can find that in all the places that you find Taskmaster. And Paul, people can find also like your work online, but Paul Williams, do you have like is there a place that you like them to go to find, you know, music or comedy or anything, dates?
I don't know. Not really. I usually always put my link in my bio on Instagram. So go check out my... My bio on Instagram.
Link in bio.
Yeah. Yeah, link in bio for sure. Yeah. But no, thanks so much for having me.
Mate, thank you for doing it. It's been really fun. I've appreciated it. Thanks, mate.
Cheers.
Listener.